Hey there, Shopomaniacs! You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front-end web design development. I'm Dave Rupin. With me is Chris Coyer.
Hey, it is, we're still in our series. How to Think Like a Front-End Developer is the series we're running here on Shop Talk Show. It's been our first one of these series. I don't know, have we ever run a series before? I don't know. I don't mean to just ramble at the beginning here, but the point is
there was that time we did about 42 rapid fires in a row because we were busy with conferences.
Sure. And in this series so far, and we've even had a little feedback about this, is that we've kind of, I don't know, in the beginning of the series, talked to people that are certainly more HTML and CSS focused or whatever. And some people are like, are you going to talk to any JavaScript developers or front-end developers with any, like a different type of skill set? And yeah, of course we are. You know, that's kind of the point of this series. So we have someone who is a front-end developer who comes at this job, I guess, from a very interesting perspective. Peggy Razis. Did I get that right, Peggy? Hi, Peggy.
Yes, you did. Hey, Chris and Dave, thanks so much for having me on the show. I'm super excited to be here.
Oh, yeah. It's our pleasure for sure. So the unique perspective I'm talking about is, so you are the engineering manager for Apollo GraphQL. Can you tell us about that, what that job is, what Apollo GraphQL is, kind of set the stage for your, I don't know, position in the world of websites?
Yeah, totally. So I am an engineering manager at Apollo, where I lead a team focused on developer experience. So that's kind of a broad term, but on any given day, you know, I'm helping developers on Twitter and on GitHub resolve any issues, surfacing any concerns, writing documentation, speaking at conferences, giving workshops, advising on some of our open source strategies. So it's really a broad role, but it's very exciting because I feel like, you know, I'm closest to the developers who are using our tools every day. Apollo is a complete platform for managing your data. And the technology that this platform is centered around is GraphQL. So GraphQL is a specification for client-server communication. It's where your microservices describe the data that they have, and then your clients then describe the data that they need. So, you know, Apollo is a complete implementation of GraphQL. What does that kind of mean? Basically, it means we have two runtime libraries, a client and a server, and then we also have a whole host of developer tooling, integrations with VS Code and GitHub, and also a cloud service that exposes metrics and does performance alerts. Yeah, so I'm kind of rambling, but basically Apollo is just a great way for you to manage your data. And that's something that's really important as a front-end developer.
Yeah, it is really a cool thing, if you ask me. I'm pretty stoked on it lately as we've started using it at CodePen. But I think some people are kind of become aware of GraphQL, and they see maybe their first exposure to it is that, like, it's vaguely JSON-like syntax. It's, you know, curly brackets, but with no commas or colons or anything, where it's just like describing this like piece of data that you want. You're like, I want movies, and movies have directors and in the, you know, whatever. And you can see that. And then you're like, that somehow magically turns into JSON data that has that stuff. Like, that's the query is that first thing I described, and the data that comes back is that second thing. And you're like, wow, that's cool. But then maybe you're just like, well, I don't know how to, you know, whatever. Like, that's, it's interesting. It's, I like the syntax, but what do I actually do with that? Like, I have a MySQL database sitting here or something that, like, it doesn't speak in that language, you know? And then to find out that, you know, through various tooling and stuff, like, no, this can be yours. You know, we very much have a MySQL database at CodePen, and through various Apollo products that have, you know, can build in React and wrap our stuff in query components and get that data out of, you know, now I'm rambling, but it's just been like, holy cow, like this was closer within reach than I thought it was. And so it's been sweet to work with. And I find it particularly kind of empowering for our front end developers. You know, no longer do we need to build out a component and then like ask somebody for a REST API. You know, it's kind of like, no, it's just there. You know, there was some configuration for us, but once that data is there, it's just kind of there forever. And it's kind of like sayonara REST, which is cool.
Yeah, totally. I love what you said about empowering front-end developers, because that's kind of where I see it as well. Like, I think Apollo and GraphQL really like lower the barrier of entry to building really complex data-driven apps. I actually sent out a tweet like a couple days ago just asking if any like bootcamp students, for example, had any experiences using GraphQL and Apollo. And I was like so blown away by the responses that, these students who were like new to programming were able to complete really complex apps and learn GraphQL in 2 weeks. It's really awesome to see. I think oftentimes getting data into your app is one of the most complex parts of front-end development, and Apollo is really what makes that easy.
Very cool. And you know, I was very pleased to find out that I guess Apollo is what brings this particular power to it, but that it manages your kind of client state too, like things that aren't in our database and don't need to be and will never be, like what modal is open, which tab is open, like just things that you kind of think of as local client state, it handles as well, and handles it kind of like at a global store level. So we had some stuff in Redux in our app, and we're just like, oh, cool, we get to ditch that because it's so much easier to just like write client data to it and have it kind of behave in the same way that changes to that data kind of trickle down to wherever needs it as long as you're subscribed to. And I was like, God, this is great. It's just been feeling really great. So thanks for your work on Apollo. It's pretty cool. But this series is kind of, you know, it's not, this show isn't exactly like, let's just talk about Apollo the whole time, although maybe we'll end up doing that anyway. But it's kind of, you know, the series is called How to Think Like a Front-End Developer. So I guess we'll start with this. It sounds like you do, because I heard you say it in the pre-show a little bit. Like, do you consider yourself, you think of yourself as a front-end developer? I know it's not your job title, but is that your job to some degree?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think, like, front-end developer is such a broad term. It's hard to really define like what exactly a front-end developer is because there's so many different specialties, right? Like you can be a specialist in SVG animations and be a front-end developer and not write any JavaScript at all. Or you could be more working on the data layer like I am and not writing any CSS, for example, and still be considered a front-end developer. So I think it's kind of, you know, as long as you're touching UI or touching something like a data layer that's tangentially related to UI, I think, you know, you can identify as a front-end developer.
So that's the tie that binds, though, is that like it touches something the user touches?
Yeah. I think that's a pretty good qualification because it's now expanded to more than just websites, right? Like before I was working at Apollo, I was a UI developer working on React and React Native. So, you know, because I'm working on React Native, like, does that make me a mobile developer? Or like, does that make me a front-end developer because it's JavaScript and React and I'm sharing components with the web as well? So it definitely, I think, JavaScript and React and really everything that's kind of popped up in the past couple of years have really expanded the definition of what a front-end developer is. And I think that's really exciting because there's, you know, there's always something new to learn and there's so many awesome things going on in the ecosystem.
So there's different specialties, you know. I like that you mentioned like an SVG animator. I don't think a lot of people would bring that up as a front end specialty, but totally is, of course. The biggest divide we've been seeing so far, I think, is specifically between people who are like quite good at and specialize in and like and are hired to do and work directly on that JavaScript engineering layer, which is like, I deeply know React. I bring my React skills to my job. I build components. I deal with data. I engineer this thing. Maybe I'm even performance focused and I care about that and work on that. But what I don't do is necessarily like really dig into like accessibility or scaling out our design system or things like that. Like that's just not what they're interested in. It's not what they're hired to do. It's not what their job needs them to do. But they're both front end developers, you know, like do you see that around? Cause you're in a kind of interesting position. You work, you know, on developer tooling and, you know, go to conferences and such. So does that seem to be like, a divide right now, or is, do you see it differently?
I think it's pretty accurate. I do think, though, like, as a front-end developer, like, you should have basic fluency and accessibility regardless. Like, if you're building UI, you should know some basic principles of accessibility and not just leave that to a specialist. But I think, I guess maybe there is probably a little bit of a divide between people who, you know, are working constantly on HTML and CSS and more people who are doing, like, JavaScript engineering, working on a data layer, working on state management, that sort of thing. But I think the important thing is that we should all try to be, you know, fluent in all aspects and just try to learn from each other as much as possible and not say that anyone is, you know, superior to the other. Because even though I work on like more JavaScript data layer stuff, I still really respect people who are awesome at CSS and, SVG and stuff, because it's really, really tough. And I think, you know, the more that we can kind of share ideas and learn from each other, I think the better off we'll all be.
Well, I love it. So process-wise is kind of a question we've been asking people. If you were involved in a project, let's say rather than just stepping outside of being an engineering manager at a DevTools kind of place, is in the, you know, it looks like in the past you've worked at Macy's, you worked at the Major League Soccer, which I imagine you're just a developer, right? Maybe still a manager, but worked on directly on a single product or a suite of products, right?
Yeah. My role is kind of broad. Like, even though I'm an engineering manager, we don't have like a tech lead on our team. So I'm kind of that as well. I'm still executing, like doing like docs infrastructure stuff. So I'm still definitely engineering as well.
Sure. So let's say a project came along that you had to build something for somebody. What is like the perfect situation for you? Like, what would your role be? What would that client be? Or what would that product be? And who would you be working with, if anybody? And that kind of thing. Do you think about that ever? You know, like, what's the perfect project for you?
Yeah, I mean, now that I guess in some ways, like, our documentation and developer content is a project. But I guess, like, if I'm, you know, trying to put myself more in the role of what I used to do as a UI engineer, I'm working on a project. I would hope that we would be able to use React and GraphQL, just because I don't think I would ever build an app without them at this point. So I guess kind of taking the role of a UI engineer, I think I would really want people that probably are comfortable, you know, kind of diving into like building a GraphQL server, but also are comfortable kind of working on React components and that sort of thing. I definitely want a person on my team who is awesome at CSS, because I am not. So I would love to have someone, who's great at that. Definitely someone who is an accessibility specialist, because I think that's so important.
Like a group of specialists, though, sounds like where you're headed.
Yeah. I like the idea of a group of specialists, but I also like people who are super flexible too. Like when I was a UI engineer at Major League Soccer, we shared a lot of code between our React and React Native app. So sometimes I would like have to like dive into like Objective-C and like Kotlin and stuff and like start working in that. So I think people who maybe are specialists in one area, but have the curiosity to kind of like work in broad areas, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just want to work with people who are curious and excited. So I guess maybe that's really the only qualification.
That's great. It's funny that you mentioned like, I definitely will, like, if possible, I'd like to work with React and GraphQL. And I kind of get that, because it's like, oh man, it just feels so good sometimes, doesn't it? I'm definitely in kind of honeymooning on it still a little bit, but it's not a requirement that you use React to work with GraphQL. Dave and I were just chatting about how he's monkeying about with Vue for a client thing. And there's no, like, certainly GraphQL and Vue can play together nicely, or really any other JavaScript library. Isn't that right?
Yeah, totally. So Apollo client is Vue layer agnostic. So you can use in vanilla JavaScript. You can use it with Angular, Vue, React. I think there's a Scala implementation. Like, there's so many. There's Apollo iOS, Apollo Android.
Why not?
Like, yeah, there's literally like so many you know, always popping up from our community members. So yeah, you can really use it with anything. And that's what's so awesome about GraphQL is that it's completely flexible. And even on the server side as well, like we, you know, obviously have Apollo Server and recommend for, you know, most teams that they write their server in JavaScript, but you don't have to write your server in JavaScript. You can write it in pretty much any language that you want. So,
when like data changes in an Apollo store or whatever, like data is mutated in some way and some other component is like wanting to know about that, there's just kind of like standard APIs for like, hi, whoever's listening, something has changed. And it really doesn't need to be a query component. It could be like, how does it work in vanilla JavaScript?
Yeah, so this is kind of like when I teach workshops and stuff, literally the first thing that I have people do after they create the client is just call client.query. And you can pass your query in, and it's an asynchronous function. So, you know, like dot then off of it, mm-hmm. and you get your result. And you can just console log your result right there in like 10 lines of code. So obviously, you know, if you were working on a React app and you're working with the vanilla JavaScript, you know, version of Apollo client, it's kind of annoying because then you kind of have to manage all of that loading state yourself and in the lifecycle methods, and it gets a little tedious. That's why we have the view layer integrations to make things like that easier, to make it more reflect how people are using Apollo client for that particular view layer, whether that's React or Angular or Vue or mm-hmm. whatever else.
But you like the React one.
Yeah, I mean, I'm partial to React, but I think like Vue is really awesome as well. I keep meaning to like spend some time with Vue and dive deep into it. I think Guillaume, he's the maintainer of Vue Apollo, has done just a really fantastic job, not only with the library, but also with the developer tooling around it. Like the Vue CLI is like super cool, and the dashboard and stuff. So yeah, I definitely want to dive deeper into that someday when I have time.
It'd be interesting. I wonder, is it like an alternative to, like, would you couldn't really use Vuex or to use Apollo on top of Vuex, or does Vuex just not even come into it? Because Apollo is now the state management system. Probably that.
Yeah, I think I've seen, like, tweets and stuff from community members saying that they don't use Vuex at all, that they just use Apollo for all their data because, you know, we have, obviously, the remote data piece of it, but then with like Apollo Link State, you can do the local state piece of it as well, and then just kind of have this one like unified interface to all of your data. So I guess that's how you would do it, but I'm not a Vue developer, so I you know, I couldn't say for certain.
So what's like the hard part about front end development these days? Whatever your role of it is, you know, like what do you find the most challenging about it? You know, and from whatever personal perspective you have, you know, we've talked to some people who are, you know, they're very much do client work. And so the hard part for them is sometimes dealing with clients, but we tried to steer them away from, like, aside from the, you know, the people problems that we all have to some degree, what's like the hard computer part of your job? You know, like what's the most challenging part of front end development these days?
Well, I think, I guess, like before GraphQL, to me, the most challenging part about front-end development was really the data layer, because a lot of people have microservices architecture, so they have a bunch of different services that they need to fetch data from, and then they have a bunch of different clients that they need to support, whether that's, you know, mobile apps or websites or, you know, VR or like IoT or chatbots or whatever, and each of those clients is querying those services in similar but also different ways. So you kind of need something in the middle to, you know, clean up that and make sure you're not duplicating a lot of code and to kind of push a lot of that complexity from the client side over to the server side so it's more reusable. And that's kind of where GraphQL and Apollo come in and solve that problem. So I would say that used to be the most challenging thing about front-end development, but I think, you know, now that we have best practices surrounding, you know, GraphQL and Apollo, that's gotten easier. I will say, though, that there is, you know, kind of a ramp up learning about GraphQL, and I think that's something that my team is actively trying to do is just make it easier. We have, like, a full-stack tutorial coming out in 2 weeks and some other things we're going to announce at GraphQL Summit, but Yeah. So I would say that probably used to be the hardest part. It's not anymore, but it's, you know, there's still some rough edges that will only get better with time as more and more people start to use the technology. And
you're literally working on the hardest part in a way that must be satisfying to some degree, is to be head on tackling what you considered to be the hardest part about front end development.
Yeah, I think that's like what's so rewarding about my job is because, you know, you work with people who, you know, they're in organizations where they maybe have like a Rails monolith and, you know, their data layer is just really messy, or they have like a lot of complicated Redux code, and it's hard for people to be productive. And, you know, they bring GraphQL and Apollo in, and suddenly like they're deleting all their Redux code, and like the data layer just gets so much easier. So I would say it's definitely rewarding, but I think, you know, one of the challenges is, and we're starting to see it now, as more and more companies convert more and more of their data layer over to GraphQL, is kind of solving, okay, how do we effectively collaborate across teams, right? Because, you know, you have, you know, one large schema, you can use schema stitching for teams to independently develop schemas and then stitch them together. But that also comes with a whole nother set of challenges. So I think, you know, kind of figuring out how to scale GraphQL across enormous like organizations, I think, is kind of the challenge that we're working on now and developing tools to solve that.
Yeah, I can't imagine what huge companies, the challenges they face. I mean, we face enough of them as is at kind of at a medium scale. I find it interesting how like kind of deciding what gets exposed and what doesn't get exposed in GraphQL is interesting already, and then trying to, you know, kind of massage it and make sure it's kind of perfect, and that you're not like setting yourself up for, I don't know, for weirdness in the future. Like it can be a kind of a fresh start for an organization data wise. So like, let's do it right from the beginning. It's kind of a fun place to be. And then permissions is funny too. Like this is data I want exposed, but this is, you know, certain data is kind of like admin only, and some is very logged in only and scoped to certain users only. And that's a whole special can of worms.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we're definitely working on that. We have an operation registry that's launching it at GraphQL Summit. So you'll basically be able to, register your queries and kind of lock those down to only certain parts of your graph. So that kind of helps with the access control piece of things. But then it's also, you know, where do you do authorization? Like, do you handle that in your resolvers, or do you handle that like in the underlying services? That's something that a lot of people still struggle with. And, you know, I think it depends on the organization and their situation. And it's kind of, you know, working with these companies and understanding their needs and making sure that the tools are flexible enough to support them.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Jetpack. Jetpack is a WordPress plugin that kind of brings a lot of the power of WordPress.com to your self-hosted WordPress site. I use it. I use it on all my different WordPress sites. I think it's kind of awesome. Maybe the best advice is to have you just go look at jetpack.com/features and see if there's like things that it can do that appeal to you in some way, because there's so many different things it can do that go into so many different buckets. And even if like you use some different plugin to do what it does, I think there's a pretty good chance that the way that Jetpack does it is better, that has like less server load on your site. For example, one of the things is just like related posts, and the way that a lot of related posts work is by really hammering your MySQL database in a way that some hosts like don't even allow related post plugins, but they allow it on Jetpack because the way Jetpack does it outsources that knowledge, that like heavy MySQL-y stuff, to WordPress.com servers, and then that data just comes back to your own server and it has like no server load at all. That's just like one of a million features on Jetpack though. Some of the most important stuff for me is how it does site backups for you, integrates with VaultPress in a way. It gives you like interesting analytics that might be of appeal to you, that, you know, kind of it's just integrated right into WordPress. You can kind of check how your site is doing. You know, it does downtime monitoring. It just does all kinds of stuff. You know, there's design stuff and audience stuff and security stuff. You should just take a look and see, you know, I think it's kind of a no-brainer plugin for me. So thanks, WordPress, for sponsoring the show.
Thank you.
Dave, when you reached for Vue or we were talking about that, I'm kind of curious like what the problem set was, is because it's not necessarily like data distribution, right? It's more of like it's kind of a different set of problems you're trying to solve.
I mean, I have data problems. I mean, what do you do with like 10,000 XML files? But I think we've always called like React and Vue, like instead of like JS frameworks, we've called them like DOM management systems. And I just need something like a system in place. I just want a system that in place that people can like work and contribute to. But even in this like particular situation, I'm looking at Vue is kind of like, there's a, you know, server side rendered, and I kind of want to like push it over, but like, because it's like a legacy Java app, there's not going to be like a node process I can just spin up and be like, yeah, I got, here's the React app. Like, it's just not going to work that way. So I kind of have to be clever about how it all works. So I would wonder how easy it is to like pop GraphQL into a very legacy like Java system. Is that something people do, Peggy?
Yeah, absolutely. So so you would kind of layer a GraphQL server over your legacy Java system. So you know, that way you kind of have that JavaScript layer on top, and you would first like start with your schema and think about, okay, like what is the data that I need to expose from my legacy Java system, and more importantly, how are my clients actually consuming that data? Because it's
likely similar to like writing a REST API or something like that, but it's just kind of a GraphQL API. And
yeah, exactly.
It's more configuration than like actually writing, I don't know, queries and stuff.
So like the difference between like REST and GraphQL is kind of REST is more like resource focused. Where with GraphQL, a type can be a collection of like multiple data sources. You could have a movie type, mm-hmm. and some of them are pulling from a REST endpoint, and some of them are pulling from a database, and so it's a little bit more flexible in that way. But I think like the number one thing we tell people when they're designing their schemas is you have to write your schema how your clients are actually going to consume it. You do not want to be doing any sorting or filtering or any like manual work on the client. You kind of transforming your data. So that's really what we recommend. And it kind of like covers up a lot of the faults of legacy APIs that were designed, you know, to be maybe more backend focused, whereas GraphQL is more designing around the needs of the client.
Yeah. I mean, I think I literally have a SOAP API in here too. But then like my question is it easy to make a bad query? Like if I say like, give me all the movies or all the directors like of every movie ever or whatever, like that's a huge query. Are you just going to bomb out like databases? Does that happen? Is that kind of a pitfall? I mean, I know like Facebook uses this, so probably not, but how does that work?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That is a valid criticism of GraphQL, and that is what will happen if you don't take the proper precautions in place to, you know, make sure that you're limiting your query depth, for example, because, you know, it's a graph. You don't want to endlessly and like traverse the graph so many levels down, so you can limit your query depth. You can limit your query complexity. It'll kind of, there's plugins that you can use to analyze the complexity of your query, and you can place limits on those. You also want to be smart about, you know, when you're writing your queries and making sure that they're not too expensive. So that's kind of why we have our cloud service Apollo Engine that gives you field by field metrics for, you know, resolver timings for each step of the query. So that way, and then that integrates with like our VS Code tool, for example, which will tell you as you're writing your query out, how expensive that query is and how much time it takes on average for that query to resolve.
Seriously? That's fancy. Right in VS Code, when you write a little GraphQL query, it's like, that's probably going to take 0.25 milliseconds.
Yep. Yeah. Wow. And it uses real data. So that's something that we're announcing at like it's like technically we've had a build of it for a while, but we're trying to make it perfect before we announce in 2 weeks. But cool. Yeah, if you're using Apollo Engine and you're using the VS Code extension, you'll literally see the query timing right there in your editor. And I think like our intention is really to use these metrics to help front-end developers make smarter decisions about the queries that they're writing. So that way, you know, you're preventing bugs before they happen. Mm-hmm. And you'll eventually, you know, be able to make smart suggestions on, you know, hey, this query is too deep. Hey, this query is too complex. It takes too much time. So that way, you know, you're eliminating problems before they happen. And I think that's really kind of our goal with GraphQL is making it safe, because you can do a lot of things wrong if you're just, you know, implementing it yourself and you're kind of cobbling tools together. But that's really why we have this complete platform. So you as a front-end developer don't have to worry about things like caching and performance when you're developing, because
that's another empowering thing too. You like just write the query and something else will handle the fancy performance magic of it. It does make me think though, like we have like, you know, I can think of one area of the site where we have like 9 components that all have pretty similar queries on them right in the component, because they all need to know the username. So it all needs to do a user query and it returns the username because they all need it or something similar to that. You know, even though they all say like, oh, well, that particular query takes this many milliseconds, it's not like it runs that query 9 times. That's also part of the magic of Apollo, isn't it? That it like kind of like smashes all those similar queries together and just makes it once and then sprinkles that data out to all the components that need it.
Yeah, so that's kind of like the client-side cache and how we normalize the data. So it like essentially you can kind of think of a GraphQL query in your mind as like this nested structure, but the Apollo cache will split out any entities with a type name and an ID. So like say you have like a list of movies, it'll split each movie out into its own separate entry into the cache with like its ID. So that way, like say you were editing something on like a movie detail page, then it will also show up for the query of the list of movies because of the normalized cache. So that's kind of something that we do.
Cool. So that that's like an Apollo feature then. Like neat. So like if I have products or something, you're like, oh yeah, let's cache those products because we'll use that again probably. And then so anytime somebody's like, give me products, you're like, oh, we have those already.
Yeah. And then if you make an edit to a specific product on another screen and then navigate back to the list of products, that query will automatically like show that updated data without refetching. So that's like the
fancy.
Yeah, it's super dope. Like that's, you get that out of the box, which is pretty astounding. And, you know, not only for your remote data, but also your local data as well, because we're able to manage that.
Yeah, pretty real-time friendly.
Yep, totally.
Yeah. We even have some stuff that we put in Firestore, and it plays pretty nicely. You know, you change it in Firestore changes the local Apollo state, and that way, like if we have this pins feature on CodePen where you can, you know, whatever, like favorites in Notion or whatever, you can kind of just pin certain pens and projects and posts or something, and it has this, you know, and so that's, it's like not MySQL data. We keep it in Firestore, so it's real time. So if you had 5 tabs open and you pin something, it's available in all those 5 tabs. It's not like you have to refresh the page to get it. And so that's why we used Firestore originally. But I wonder if just Apollo could handle it now. Like we don't even need that Firestore layer.
There's actually like an Apollo link that might allow you to query your Firestore with GraphQL. Don't quote me on this. So we actually have this for REST endpoints. It's called Apollo Link REST, which allows you to query a REST endpoint as if it's GraphQL. You lose a little bit of the benefits of GraphQL, right? Because you don't have a server running, so you lose the benefits of the smaller payloads and that sort of thing. But it'll allow you to, you know, like write a query and then it has like a at rest directive and Apollo will know, hey, pull this field from my REST endpoint. And I'm pretty sure we also have something similar for Firebase. Maybe do a search like Apollo Link, like Firebase. I'm pretty sure it exists, but
I think there is one for Firebase and not Firestore or something like that. We came up because Firestore is like the whatever, like the new I don't know. It's like an evolution of Firebase in some way, but it's different enough that everybody's old libraries that worked with Firebase usually don't work with Firebase. So anyway, feel free to write one, GraphQL community. Maybe we'll use it.
So I really love that idea of like, kind of like showing the impact of the query, like the performance while you're writing. I feel like a lot of our tooling doesn't tell us early enough when we've created a problem. So I think that's really
have
important.
You seen the NPM package one? I have that one installed where all your import statements at the top tell you how big they are.
Yes, yes. Love
yeah,
that
import
one.
Cost. It maxes out. I will let you know.
Don't look at actually, Firebase.
When you have a 28 meg bundle, it sort of just gives up. So I guess like how do you approach performance? It seems like that's kind of on top of your mind as a front end developer. How do you kind of approach
performance? So I think like the first aspect of performance is obviously like measuring. Like you want to, you can't improve performance unless you know where your bottlenecks are. So that's kind of like why we have Apollo Engine, the cloud service that'll give you like field by field metrics. And there are also definitely some precautionary measures you can take as well. So, you know, we have our client-side caching that I talked about earlier, but then we also have caching layers on the server. So with Apollo Server, there's this like data sources API that actually sets up a cache. It's in memory by default, but you can swap out like Redis or Memcache or whatever. So it hooks up to REST APIs now. We're planning ones for like SQL, and gRPC in the future, but it will actually partially cache your resources for you and use existing caching logic from your REST APIs. So it's kind of hard to visualize, but if you think of like a GraphQL query, maybe for like a Netflix-like site or something where you have movie data, and usually that movie data is static, right? Like things like the title and the summary, those are things that aren't updated that often. So you would want to cache those for longer than say, you know, a movie playback rate, like a user's like watching a movie or whatever. So with this like partial query caching, you're able to like automatically cache that static data and only fetch the dynamic data. So putting in precautions like that. Also, I think it's just, you know, taking precautionary measures with that and then also measuring and just following up, seeing where your bottlenecks are and then, you know, working to improve them.
Dave, I Googled XML to GraphQL for you to see if there's any plugins there.
Yeah.
No, it's nothing really, yeah. But GraphQL for whatever reason has inspired a new generation of clickbaity headlines in technology writing. GraphQL will
top five GraphQL plugins.
Well, here's the top three clickbait headlines. GraphQL will do to REST what JSON did to XML. Just because GitHub has a GraphQL API doesn't mean you should. REST APIs are REST in peace APIs.
Oh, gosh. I don't like when people have those clickbaity titles because honestly, I think
I think
GraphQL works well with REST. Like people always pit them against each other. Like it has to be this one or the other. But I think like layering GraphQL on top of REST is a perfectly viable solution to getting started with GraphQL and being productive immediately. And like the first, you know, data source that we wrote with this like partial query caching was for REST. We see a lot of people layering GraphQL over REST. So I don't know. I'm not a fan of those clickbaity titles because I think that the technologies can work really well together.
I saw a prominent framework developer tweet out like, remember ORM? Yuck, yuck, yuck. And I was just kind of like, Active Record wasn't terrible. It just is slow, maybe.
Well, I'm curious about this too, is that there's so much layering in our stack now that there's this MySQL at the way bottom, and then it's a Rails app. So Active Record is the thing that, you know, makes queries or whatever. And then we have some kind of layer on top of that now that's GraphQL talks to Active Record, talks to MySQL, and then it kind of gets percolates way up. What's like, if you're starting from absolute scratch, what's like the closest to the metal way to spit out GraphQL. You know?
The closest to like the
Mongo
middle
or something.
To already have a tree structure, like a flat file database.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the closest to the metal, if you're starting like from scratch, you have, you know, stuff like Prisma, which is kind of like that GraphQL ORM over a SQL database. So maybe that would be an option if you needed a database. I think it just kind of like depends on your specific situation, I guess.
Are people just not worried about that layering kind of? Like it's just, it's fast enough. It's you're not losing time in that layering so much.
Well, like GraphQL, I would say is like that layer that's closest to the client, and then kind of what's underneath, that's really up to you, you know. So I don't know, maybe some people would be critical of the layering and saying it's you know, too much like latency and time to get from point A to point B, but GraphQL is really that layer that's closest to the client. And then anything that happens underneath that is really, you can kind of combine it however you want.
GraphQL, as I understand it, like allows developers to get the data they need without like commissioning an 8-month, whatever, like upgrade to some service or something like that, like some API service. So you're just basically like, I can like get the data I need right now. Which seems awesome. I wish I could have that right now.
You can though. It's very easy to like incrementally adopt. Like it doesn't have to be an all or nothing thing.
Like controller by controller or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, you know, like
yeah.
Controller by controller, like one endpoint by one endpoint, just start building out like very small parts of your schema, then connect it to like one, you know, controller or endpoint or whatever. And then you make the client changes for that one small piece. Or what you can also do is if you're not ready to hook up your backend yet, you can just write your schema and then you can actually mock it out and then write your front end with the mock data before you've even made any backend changes. That's like another really amazing thing. That a lot of people do, or you could like use something like Apollo Link REST and you know, write GraphQL queries to query your REST endpoint if you're not ready to stand up the server yet. So there's so many different options that you can choose just based on, you know, like your situation and what the needs of your organization are. But it's definitely like not an all or nothing thing. And in fact, we recommend that people incrementally adopt and figure out what they want from their schema first before like embarking on this huge project and writing out this big schema that probably isn't going to be right the first time.
What's the security model? I know, do people just like have keys or headers that they send or, I've even to the extent I've like heard like hacker dark web circles be like GraphQL is great for hacking. Like I can just like hop into the console and get whatever data I want.
It's so easy to just expose whatever and not have thought about that off layer to it. But obviously we think about it at CodePen through Pundit.
How do I authenticate then? And then how do I kind of like make sure I haven't like given out emails and
yeah,
passwords.
So security is kind of like performance, right? Like GraphQL is so flexible that it's really, really easy to screw up that aspect if you're not doing it correctly. So that's why we kind of try to make it easier with Apollo. So one of the things that you can do is persisted queries. So like essentially it'll turn your query into a hash and you could like specify, you know, a list of hashes or whatever that were, you know, safe queries, and it'll kind of resolve from there. We also have our operation registry that I talked about before, where you can essentially register your queries, and only those queries can be made from your API. And like any other query that someone tries to write will fail immediately. So that's definitely something that we're building in that a lot of people want. I'm trying to think of what else. Yeah, those would probably be the two things that we would recommend in order to lock down your graph. Also disabling introspection in production, which we do by default. Because like someone, so one of the cool things about GraphQL is it's statically type, and you can introspect your schema and essentially gather all the types. And a hacker could, if they wanted to, use this introspection query to construct, you know, the shape of your graph. But we recommend like disabling that in production so that way people can't discern details from your graph.
Some of them are, like, you know, you have an app that has users. So you have a user query for you, the logged in user, but maybe you're looking at a piece of content that some other user created. Well, you need to do a query for them, too, because you need their avatar and username or whatever. And but for the logged in user, you might, we'll expose their email address because it's just them. They're logged in. We might need to show their email address in a settings page or something like that. But you better be careful not to expose the email address of that other user that you're querying for us too, because you're not logged in as them. So that's kind of I think that's where the tricky stuff is. Not that I write any of this stuff. This is all smarter people than me on our team. But I think it is kind of interesting what you expose and don't based on auth.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think like auth is one of those problems that's hard regardless of whether you're using GraphQL or anything else.
Yeah.
Like typically, you know, we recommend you can do your auth checks. There's this context function, and the context object is essentially something that's shared between all the resolvers in a query. So you would check the headers like within this context function, do the user lookup, and then store the user information on the context. And then from within your resolvers, you'd say, hey, check, does the user have like permission to view this data? If they do, great, let them view it. If they don't, throw an error. So that's like one way of handling it. You can like bypass that altogether and just handle authorization within your underlying services. There's also like schema directives that you can use to denote permissions in your schema. So there's definitely a couple different ways of handling it, but you know, it's kind of just depends on your situation, I guess.
Fantastic. So let's move to this our final segment here, where we're going to show Peggy some dribble shots that we've selected. This is our second week of this particular set of dribble shots. And obviously, you've listened to this whole episode so far. You know that Peggy's perspective is, as a front-end developer, is somewhat data-focused and is quite into React and GraphQL and Apollo and stuff. So that's okay. When we look at these designs, it's fine if you want to take that perspective, Peggy, or whatever else pops into your mind from your entire life as a front-end developer when you see these designs. What looks hard or weird, or what would you push back on, or it looks interesting to you, or what are the first gears that start turning when you look at this? Because ultimately we are all building out designs in a way, aren't we? This first one is progress board interface for education platform. And it looks like a bit of a Kanban board kind of situation where cards are organized into columns. You got it up?
Yes, I do.
What do you see on the...
So, my first inclination is this looks like a good project for GraphQL because it seems like there's a lot of different types of data. You kind of have information on the individual, I guess they're lessons or like some sort of like content that you'd probably pull from like one API. Then maybe you have some like user database that stores, where each kind of piece of content lives. Then it looks like there's like a chat function. So basically it looks like there's a whole bunch of different data sources that are, coming together on this one screen. And usually when you have that happening, it means you'd probably be a good candidate for GraphQL. So my first step after identifying that, yes, GraphQL would probably solve my problems here would be to think about how I should design my schema. So then I want to think, what's the data that this screen needs to expose? Do I already have this data in my schema? If not, should I add another field? Should I maybe add some query parameters to decide how to efficiently sort this data? So I think like anytime that I look at a design, my first thought is like very schema first and like, okay, do we have the data exposed that we need in order to build the screen? And if not, how do we go about adding it in a safe way?
That's one thing we didn't talk about too much is that GraphQL almost is this, can be this normalizing layer between different data sources, right? So you thought, hey, chat, that's interesting. That's probably stored in a different place than the data from these cards is stored. But it doesn't mean that our schema can't just have them be together in a way, right? Because they, it kind of doesn't matter where the data source is, right? They can all be smashed together in the end.
Yeah, yeah, totally. So you could kind of have this overarching user type or whatever that has information about the Kanban boards, but then your user type could also have a field for chat messages that would store their messages as well. So that's the great thing about GraphQL, right? Like it doesn't really matter where your data is coming from. You can kind of roll them up into any types that you need in order to display the information in your UI. And then, you know, from there, once you're kind of constructing your client side queries, thinking about, okay, well, you know, These are on different kind of like screens, so you probably don't want to request them all together, especially if you want to like do some sort of code splitting or whatever. But maybe you want to like pre-warm the cache, and when the user hovers over that chat icon, like fetch some of those messages so they're already there. Once the user clicks on it, like these are, you know, all kind of things that you think about when you're like, you know, taking like your trying to design your data layer for a particular app. But that's what's cool about GraphQL is like it's so client focused, and you're really like looking at the design, looking at what needs to be exposed, and then you know, kind of working from there instead of the more back end focused way like how people used to do it was, okay, like here is the data that is exposed. Now we have to like sort this and filter it and massage it into the format that we need. So it much more accurately reflects, I think, how front-end developers are building their apps today versus kind of just taking like the data that the back-end team gives you and trying to make sense of it all.
Fantastic. Let's click on the second one, which is titled Tracking Dashboard for Drivers Management. Kind of has a two-thirds of the screen is a big map with a little truck on it that's kind of showing a truck route. What do you think when you see this one?
I mean, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I feel like...
You can sound like a broken record.
I feel like this is another...
What's the schema look like?
It's another good case for GraphQL, right? Like you have this like driver type at the top, which has information about the how many miles they've driven and how many hours they've worked and like their telephone and their email and stuff. So that would like all be in one type. Then you kind of have, it looks like trips, like maybe trips are associated to drivers in some way. You also have like this really cool like data viz stuff. Yeah, I mean, that's like whenever you see like multiple types of data, like it's probably a sign that GraphQL would help make your life easier. It also looks like there's some sort of like real-time component to this as well, because it's kind of like Uber where you like see the preview of the car driving to the destination. So GraphQL subscriptions would be a great use case for that. So you can have truly real-time data and just see that kind of update instantaneously.
It doesn't, like, it wouldn't need to be connected to the truck. Like, the website doesn't need to connect to the truck. It just has to, the truck just needs to say, hey, here I am. And then, like, the GraphQL will subscribe to that geolocation.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Okay, the third one is called Full Screen Hover Loop Effect, which is looks like an interactive effect in which a mouse cursor kind of hovers over a link and the full page starts showing different photographs, and then they all kind of shrink into a photo gallery kind of grid-like layout. So how about this one? What goes through your mind?
Yeah, I mean, this is really cool. A lot of like, you know, kind of complex animations there with like the photos. Definitely, you know, I have mad respect for people that do the animation work because I am terrible at it. And it looks like this, you know, it looks so easy and it looks so fluid, but I'm sure it's like actually really hard to implement. I'm seeing kind of like data that looks pretty static. So maybe I would use something like Gatsby in order to build out this site. I don't know. Have you guys used Gatsby before?
I haven't used it, but I watch it because it does look cool, and I get how nice it is to have server-side rendering, and it's like all server-side rendered. And I also get how it's nice to work with nice data management tools and React components and stuff. So it's no surprise to me how much that resonates with people. Like, I like building things this way, and so there's that. I am curious, when we look at this, how there's obviously assets, image assets in here.
Yeah.
And what is it like to do like URL management or asset management in a GraphQL world? Like, I think of how our static stuff, maybe Gatsby deals with this in some elegant way, has like a URL to a asset in Rails, has it puts it in a specific place, and it does cache busting at the end of the URLs for the, like, you know, it's like chriscoyer.jpg turns into chriscoyer-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah.jpg. So if it ever, you know, so that we can set caching headers on it that are far out, and we get the good performance from that. And if it ever changes, it changes that string so that it breaks the cache. So it's like, that's like a whole asset management thing that's kind of like part of the framework. But then it's like, I want to get that URL into GraphQL in a way so that I can use it in my React components. That's like, feels like weird and tricky.
Yeah. So I guess you would like use like a CMS or something for your assets. I know like Gatsby has a whole bunch of different hookups that you can use for that. Honestly, I'm not too familiar with that sort of thing, but my guess is like GraphQL is flexible to make anything like that kind of work. So I think you could probably do it. And I think there's even some like GraphQL based CMSs, like Graph CMS, maybe Contentful has like a GraphQL API over their stuff, and you could query that all very seamlessly into your Gatsby site.
Yeah, GraphQL doesn't care, right? It'll have a URL field, and the URL field just will be correct somehow. It's somebody else's job to make that URL correct.
Exactly, yeah. You can kind of just layer it over anything, and it'll magically come alive for you. At least, you know, Gatsby is really like a lot of magic. Like the image optimization stuff, I don't know if you've ever used like Gatsby Image, but it allows you, it like automatically optimizes your images for you based on, you know, like if they're fixed, it'll optimize the resolution. And if not, it'll optimize the size. And it makes it like so easy to just like really make smart decisions about that. So I'd probably like use Gatsby Image here too. It's really awesome. You should check it out. It's a lot of fun.
Awesome. This next one is a mobile focused one. So, you know, it's not tremendously difficult looking. It's like kind of a landing page with some fun vector graphics and stuff, kind of a landing page kind of thing for mobile. What do you see with the design like this?
Yeah.
Maybe no GraphQL at all on this one, huh?
Yeah, I mean, this one looks pretty simple. Like, maybe adding GraphQL would just be, like, over-architecting things. Kind of like, we use, like, Gatsby for all our landing pages for Apollo, so maybe you would spin up a quick Gatsby site for this. It's fun. Or maybe you would just use vanilla JS if it's just, like, a couple images and some text and some, like, very basic buttons and stuff. But yeah, it looks pretty standard. Maybe does not need GraphQL.
But let's say it did in some way. Is there mobile-specific considerations for GraphQL? Not really, right? It doesn't care who consumes it.
You mean like this is like a mobile app instead of like a just like a responsive website?
Well, I don't know. Maybe, let's say it is, you know?
Yeah, I mean, well, it works out the box with React Native. Like, literally, it's the exact same. I think it works with like Ionic and stuff too. I'm not really entrenched in the Angular community, but yeah, works great with mobile. We have Apollo iOS and Apollo Android too. So if you wanted to add some GraphQL in there, you could definitely find a way.
Great. And this last one, I think we can probably guess. It's called Short Stash 2, and it's like a very simple kind of image focused, typography focused. It's a little unclear whether it's a website at all, but that's in the grand tradition of these dribble shots we're showing people. So Gatsby Image, huh?
Yep, Gatsby Image. That's definitely what I would use for this one, for sure.
All right, fantastic.
Well, thank you, Peggy, so much for coming by and sharing the good news, the gospel of GraphQL with us. We really appreciate it. My gears are turning. I don't know. We'll see how it goes, but it may be my only hope. But anyway, for people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
Well, I don't know about giving me money, but people can follow my Twitter at Peggy Raisis. I'm at Peggy Raisis on Twitter, GitHub, Medium, all the usual places. So just come find me there and, be sure to tell me how you're enjoying GraphQL.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I think a lot of people have benefited from your perspective. So, and thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to start our favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you enjoy this series, share it on Twitter. That would be really helpful for us. We'd really love that. So thank you very much. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Hey, shoptalkshow.com.